Welcome to See Homeschoolers 2017 National School Choice Week online conference, sponsored by the National Alliance of Secular Homeschoolers. I am your host, Mary Buckroff, and today we'll be conversing with Kate Laird on the subject of classical education and unschooling. The title of her conversation is Unschool When You Can, Teach When You Must. Good morning, Kate. It's lovely for you to join me today.
Good morning, Mary. Thank you very much.
I'm personally very excited to have this conversation with you, as I just finished reading your book, which is chock full of, I think, fascinating information. Your book, Homeschool Teacher, A Practical Guide to Inspiring Academic Excellence. I love that title. And I am excited to talk with you about this. So the first thing that I think I'd like to start with, if it's okay with you, is this explaining a little bit about the classical education model and what you like and don't like about that, and then a little bit about the unschooling model and what you like and don't like. You go into some detail in your book, but would you share some of that information with our listeners?
Yes. So when I first started homeschooling, I read lots of books, and I was looking ahead to, because we lived geographically remotely, I was looking ahead for 12 years of homeschooling. How am I going to do this? I had no idea. And I found that all the books were either very strict school-at-home classical education, or don't worry about it, they'll be fine, they'll just learn everything they need to learn by themselves. And neither one of them really worked for me. I thought, that's not how I learned. And so my method was sort of to take what I really liked about the classical method and what I really liked about unschooling and put them together. So the classical method is based on reading classical works. It's a very traditional education. It looks a lot like education in the 1850s. And there's a lot of reading of these classical works, summarizing them, dictation, copywork, memorization, a lot of attention to history, which I love. That was my major in school. I love history. So I appreciate, that's one of the things I really like about the classical system. On the other hand, the unschooling, there's a lot of trust in students. They'll be able to figure out what's interesting to them, and they'll follow their own leads. A lot of people I've heard refer to that as following down rabbit holes. You just keep learning more and more about it, and that interest-driven learning is so powerful. And I find, you know, if there's a lot of emphasis on getting through a certain amount of specific work a day, that there isn't time for that interest. So I love that part about unschooling. But then I thought about myself at that age, and I would have missed so many things if I'd just been allowed to follow what I was interested in. I followed math and science far more than I would have, because some great teachers gave me a little bit of information, which was enough to spark that interest. But if I'd only been following my own things, I wouldn't have gone there. So I really tried to combine the best of both those worlds when teaching my own children.
So, yes, so beautiful. So in reading your book, and I have a freshman in high school, this year, my daughter, and I have so many different thoughts about it. When reading your book, you seem to be very academic, which is fabulous. Obviously, we're secular academic homeschoolers. Can you give a little idea, a little glimpse into what one of your days homeschooling looks like, how you do balance that classical education model with the unschooling model and make that work for your children?
Well, when they were little, I sort of sat them down, and I think I was, you know, if I'd had access to more information at the time, we're in the middle of the nowhere, and I had no internet. In the early years, I was far too much in a sort of school-at-home model. I'd sit them down and say, okay, now we're going to have math, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that, and it was very, very rigid at that time. I think if I were doing it again, I would still be rigid about some things, because I think consistency is really helpful, but I think I would be more flexible about how much we did and how much I tried to achieve in a year. I kind of wanted them to know everything by the time they were 10, and that was perhaps unrealistic.
Perhaps. You don't know some children, maybe.
But the way our homeschool sort of evolved into is I looked at what they were really interested in, and once they knew how to read successfully, which actually took a long time with one daughter who's a bit dyslexic, but once they could read, I just thought all that reading I did as a child, I did on my own. Reading in school was just this burden, and I just loved reading with no assignments and no comprehension exercises. I had comprehension, I hope, but no comprehension exercises. And I loved every minute of it. And if I didn't love it, I'd start a new book and put the old one away. And so all the way through elementary school, I think this is one of the things I did right, is I just said, go read. And in my mind, I was looking for 30 hours a month. But I didn't care if they did 6 hours in a day, you know, or they did an hour a day. It was how it worked out for them. If they hadn't been reading, and because we didn't have TV, they did read a lot. But if they hadn't been, I might have been a bit more rigid and said, okay, you know, after lunch, we're reading for an hour. Nobody talks, just read. But because they would do it on their own, I didn't worry about it. And they're both really, really strong readers, even the dyslexic one. They read a lot, and it's given them huge amounts of stamina. They know that they can read, you know, a book every 2 days or whatever. And so when I give them a big, thick book to read for history now in high school, they don't even think twice about it. They know they can handle it. And you get that way by reading thousands of books. It's just going to be easier for a really strong reader to read the history assignments or the literature assignments or the science assignments in high school and college. So that was really important to me. It's kind of scary to do that, to say, oh, I'm just going to throw out all these ideas about teaching literature to elementary school students. And once I'd finished doing it and I'd worried about it, I read Nancy Atwell's book, The Reading Zone, and she won the International Teacher of the Year Award a couple of years ago. And if I'd read that when they were five, I would have had a much easier life, because it was exactly that. Just let them read. She really emphasizes doing a lot of reading and not worrying about tacking on lots of exercises. So that's really where we unschooled most successfully, I would say. And in other subjects, in science, we did a lot of unschooling. It was constantly around us. We studied nature, and I didn't worry about, because I knew they were getting enough science. I didn't worry about following a set curriculum. But then with things like math, it was much more rigid. We followed, eventually got on to Singapore math, and we did that every day and did that in a very traditional school sort of way.
I have, now, of course, I already had a ton of other questions, and I even have more now with what you just said. So I'll just sort of dive in here. So you mentioned just now, and of course it's in your book, about building that stamina, that reading stamina, that writing stamina. So my first question is, what if you have a reluctant reader, like a really reluctant reader? What advice or insight could you give to a parent And not only a reluctant reader when they're young, maybe in, you know, the early elementary years, but what if you're coming to homeschooling with a middle schooler or a high schooler and they're a reluctant reader? What would you recommend to, is it too late to help them build up that stamina that you talk about them needing, especially if they themselves say that they want to go to college? How do you, as a parent, how do you help that child?
I'm not a very good example of this myself, because when my younger daughter had trouble reading when she was in the first grade, I thought, oh, why can't she get this? She could read this word yesterday, and I'd get very frustrated. And it took me an embarrassingly long time to say, maybe she just is having a lot of trouble. Maybe she's a bit dyslexic. She got through that and started reading well, but she reads in a different way. And it took me a long time to work that out, that her reluctance wasn't that she didn't like reading. It was that it was incredibly difficult for her. So I think my first advice would be to look at, possibly if the child's having a lot of difficulty learning to read, is there some dyslexia? Is there some kind of problem like that? Because if you're trying to go ahead, as I did, with a child with difficulties and just sort of banging on with the same old routines, it's not going to work. I can tell you that it doesn't work. But I would say, no, it's not too late. It's never too late to give students or adults a love of reading. It may be that they find audiobooks are easier. They may find that reading along and listening is really helpful. It's a perfectly valid way to get books into your head, as it were. I mean, if you're listening to them. For my part, I don't find it as easy because I don't remember what I hear as well as what I read. But that's not true for everyone. So some of these audiobooks now, they're fantastic. We listen to a lot of them when we're traveling and things. So that's one way, I mean, is to look at it, is to not be so restrictive about the definition of reading. It doesn't all have to come words off a page. Some people find reading a digital book is so much easier than a paper book because they can change the font and they can change the size. You can now change some of the Kindles. You can change to an open dyslexic font, which is a little bit easier to read. So there's a lot of technology now that can help students who have physical difficulties with reading. Getting glasses, getting checked for glasses is obviously a really good thing. But then, so you've gone through all that, and you have someone who still doesn't like to read because it's boring, and they don't like it. Then I think it's probably time to be a bit more proactive. Obviously, this is probably easier with a small child than a teenager. But, you know, my husband went to a classic British boarding school. It's starting at 7, it's just like you see in the movies. And his headmaster, when he was in high school, said, right, all you boys, you're going to go read for an hour after lunch. I don't care what you read, except it has to come from the school library. So it had to be a book. It couldn't be comics or a magazine or something. And they were all just sent to their rooms and made to read for an hour. And it was brilliant. And then they would write little comments about it, if they liked only if they liked a book, and recommend it to their friends. And it was such a great idea. And these are high school students. And, you know, they were, like any high school students, they weren't particularly interested in it. But there was absolute consistency. They had to do it every day. And they had total choice about what they read. And they were guided by their friends' recommendations. And obviously, that's a little harder to do homeschooling. But you can find lists online. Nancy Atwell, who I mentioned earlier, has a website where her students recommend books. Librarians can help you, especially if you go and say, oh, I really liked this book. And librarians can tell you, oh, well, here's another one that you might enjoy. So that's a great way, that free reading, with no writing attached to it, without any, you've got to write an essay on this. I talk about it in my book, but a former student of mine was reading The Outsiders in high school. And that was one of my favorite books when I was in middle school. I think I read it half a dozen times. I think I wasn't supposed to read it, so I was really enjoyed it. And she hated it. And I said, how can you hate this book? It's fantastic. But she had to read it as part of school, and it had been turned into a school exercise. She had to fill out 20 pages of notes on it and take quizzes on it. And I think that gets in the way of loving reading.
Yeah, when I came to that part of your book, reading that, I was nodding along of how different reading was for pleasure on my own as a student than when it was assigned in a part of schoolwork or classes. It can be, and I wonder if that isn't true for, if it's true for everyone, or if it's especially true for those of us who naturally love to read, that, you know, it just sucks all of the good right out of the book when you have to read on a time schedule and constantly answering questions or doing quizzes or proving your understanding of a book instead of just getting absolutely immersed and lost in the book itself.
Yeah, I think that it definitely is a certain sort of reading level where you find yourself, again, I keep going back to Nancy Atwell's words about the reading zone. I think that was one of her students came up with that word, where you're just taken away. But I think we make kind of a false dichotomy between students who like to read and students who hate to read. And I sort of wonder, and obviously this is not, I haven't studied this, and this isn't, I can't say this is true of every student, but the students who say they hate to read, they probably love TV. They love stories. And I think a lot of it is finding the right book. And if you can sort of introduce students, and that's where a librarian comes in handy, and I think you also have to be okay with students saying, I didn't like this book. And it was, especially when it's a book you really loved as a child yourself, and you think, oh, this is perfect. The student will love this book. Maybe they won't. Maybe they'd rather be reading something that was more technical or a how-to or a true life adventure story. It doesn't matter what they're reading. Not everyone's going to love novels. I've gone through phases in my life where I've done nothing but read novels, and then I'll go for 2 or 3 years where I don't pick up a novel. Everything I read is scientific, popular science, and then I'll read history. I mean, I don't think we have to insist that students love a certain genre, but I think if we keep trying, I'm sure there's some out there who will not like reading no matter what you do, but I think it's important not to give up too soon. And I think it's also important not to try to teach those classics. It's one of the things I have sort of a difficulty with classical education. You know, the American high school, that they all read the same classics, and they read the same classics that they've been reading for the last 100 years. But if students can't read well, they're going to hate those books because they're too hard. So I think it's better to work on that stamina. And if they don't read the classics in high school, I'm not sure it matters if they like reading at the end of it. That's kind of heresy, but I'd rather have a student that can pick up a book and read it than has read all those, you know, the Mensa list or whatever.
Right. Okay, great. My next question that is, it's a little bit of a segue, but in keeping with a similar vein, you yourself are a college graduate, Harvard, as a matter of fact, and I'm curious then, as your children have gotten older now, you have one of your daughters, is she high school level yet? She is, isn't she?
They both are now, yeah.
Oh, they both are now, okay.
Yeah.
I'm making an assumption, and so please correct me if I'm wrong, that they're more than likely college bound. And so I'm curious, how has your homeschooling this classical mixed with this unschooling model. How has that evolved or changed as you've gotten into high school, as far as you talk about, you know, every student needs to be able to eventually have a general grasp of a 5-paragraph essay and be able to write a science lab and those sort of things. So how are you progressing in high school as far as meeting college requirements or putting together a high school transcript or portfolio and that sort of thing?
Well, that has been kind of a harsh reality for me, that I find myself conforming more to what's expected in a more traditional high school, and I don't necessarily like it. For example, in history, they've been doing sort of the 4-year pattern of history. So they did ancient history last year, medieval time period this year. And now I'm sort of thinking, maybe they should do all of, 1600 to the present next year, so that they can get the testing done. And that's not the way I would teach the class. If I didn't have to think about college testing, I would do it over, spread it out over 2 years. And so now I'm thinking, I should have pushed a little harder in the early year. Yeah, you second guess yourself a lot more if you're looking at college. I think it's possible not to. So I do hope that they'll go to college, and I'm organizing their high school to put them on that track. So with literature, I am assigning literature now. I'm still assigning probably 50% of their books. So they're still reading for fiction for fun and science for fun and things like that. So I'm trying to stay out of it as much as I dare, but I also want them to know how to write a literature paper. So I assign them things that go with their history. So they read the Iliad and the Odyssey last year, which are, they're the classical things that are assigned in a lot of high schools. And then this year they've read Beowulf. Later on in the year, we'll read Othello. But there's a lot of time in there that I'm leaving free, so they hope they keep reading on their own and enjoy it.
So I actually am speaking for myself in many ways when I ask this question. There are several. I graduated college. I don't have a Harvard education, and I assume that there is some difference. I don't have all the classics under my belt. I love to read, and I'm a voracious reader, really, but not really a lover of all things classic. I wasn't a history major. So sometimes I have some hesitations about when questions get asked. I don't just necessarily have that information to pull right out of my little toolbox. And so what sort of advice or recommendations would you give then for someone who, say, is maybe starting the middle school or even high school years when it comes to teaching, but being a little intimidated maybe by, the idea of Beowulf or the Iliad or, in my case, algebra, and moving forward with their soon-to-be or, starting high school student?
Well, the first, just before I started teaching writing at the University of New Hampshire, I was quite nervous. I was 26 and not very much older than my students, actually younger than some of them. And I met an older man who'd been a professor. He was retired, and he said, "Don't worry about it. Whatever you've got to say is all news to them." And I sort of think that that's the same thing about teaching my students. I'm teaching, so-called teaching them things that my kids, that things I don't really know well myself. I think about chemistry. I took it. I think I did well. I don't remember any of it. Same with calculus. I haven't gotten there yet, but I'm dreading it. But you have to, you don't. It's nice if you're a day ahead. It's nice if you can come speak from some level of confidence. But you don't really have to be. You know, you mentioned the classics. I had read The Iliad and the Odyssey, but not for part of school. I never read it academically. I just read it on my own. And I had never read Beowulf. It doesn't really matter, because when I find, and I'll never be an English literature professor, because I don't have a lot of patience with the idea that students have to find a list of secret, deep hidden meanings in a text. I don't think you need to look at a book like a separate piece and say, oh, this is a Cain and Abel story. That's not what it is for a 14-year-old reading it for the first time, whether or not they're familiar with the Cain and Abel story anyway. When students confront a piece of literature for the first time, they're only confronting it as a 14-year-old with whatever background they have. When I read that book for the first time as a teenager, I thought to myself, wow, I can empathize with this guy. Could I be that horrible? Do I have that in me? And that's what I got out of it. And that was important. That meant a lot to me. I didn't write a paper on it because I just read it for fun. But I made my kids write a paper on it because I mean like that. But they didn't. I didn't ask them to go deep into it, you know, and try to extract the whatever secrets an English teacher might have found out from it. I wanted to know what they got out of it. And the act of writing about literature, whether it's a classic, whether it's popular fiction, whatever you're writing about, the act of writing to me is not to reach some answer that SparkNotes tells you you're supposed to find. To me, it's about pausing, slowing down, and thinking about the book through your writing. I think when you write about a piece of literature, you get more out of it than when you just read about it. Now, that may seem in contradiction for what I said about elementary school not having a lot of add-on things. But I know that, you know, when I assigned Beowulf, I said, okay, write a paper on it. If you can't think of an idea, I'll tell you what to write about. But try and come up with something. And so I had one daughter write a paper talking about Tolkien, Lord of the Rings, and all the imagery she found in Beowulf that echoed in Lord of the Rings. And Tolkien was a literature professor and actually did a translation of Beowulf. So she read that, and she looked at that, and that's what she wrote about. It's not what a lot of people would care about in Beowulf, but for her, it was a way of going deeper into it. My other daughter went through, and she looked for the way Seamus Heaney had translated words for God and what he'd used as God and what the words were in the original Old English. She can't read it, but she could do a control F search on the computer and find all the instances. So she was going at it from a sort of mechanistic, technical thing. She got a huge amount out of it, and neither of them fit that standard writing about literature mold, but I think they both got a lot out of it by going in their own angle. So that's going back to your question about how can you prepare for that. I knew nothing about either of those topics, but I can read their paper and I can say, well, that's not quite the footnote style I wanted, and you know, I'm interested in this part, and I don't understand what you're saying here. So I can be an audience in that sense to their writing, even if I don't know what they're talking about. I haven't read Lord of the Rings 87 times, so I probably just have to take it on faith that what she's saying is right in her Lord of the Rings Beowulf paper.
That's fascinating, though. I mean, to me, that's such an important little epiphany that you've just shared. It, in that sense, then, it really is about the pursuit of knowledge. It's just about learning. It's not about hitting a certain, like you said, you know, SparkNotes says you should have picked up on this, and then there's that, and all that other sort of thing. In that sense, and I would think that in a lot of ways, then that spurs on the love of learning even further. That it's not beaten out of them through some arbitrary set of expectations to be met from reading a piece of literature.
Yeah, I think the one thing that I try to remember is the people who write SparkNotes, I keep picking on SparkNotes, but that hopefully the author of the guide or an English teacher teaching it to a large class has read the book 5 or 6 times. And when you're coming at it from the first read, you don't have that depth of knowledge, whether you're an adult or whether you're a high school student. So it's really easy to get caught up in looking symbolism hunting and things like that. But that's really probably more appropriate. I mean, if it's fun, if you enjoy doing it, great. But if for most people, it's probably more appropriate after the 5th or 6th time you've read the book. And all the books I'm assigning, I haven't read 5 or 6 times. So I'm still on that junior level.
Awesome. Fantastic. Okay, so, you know, you mentioned about their writing, and I know in your book, you talk about service writing and invested writing, and I personally found this fascinating. The service writing, well, I'll tell you what, would you explain that too when you talk about service writing and invested writing? I know a lot of homeschooling parents worry about how to teach writing to their students, their children. Could you talk a little bit about that those ideas you have about those two different types of writing and what they mean and how you accomplish them?
So the three types are service writing, draft and a half, and invested writing. And I made those names up. I mean, you can come up with any different thing. But so much of school writing is chopped up into genres. And I started thinking, we don't read that way. You know, if you pick up a nonfiction book, it's going to have opinion. It's going to have stories. It's going to have some research in there. It's going to have all these elements tied in together. The school genres are quite artificial in that way. And so I started looking at how I use writing in my own life and how I used it in school. And so the service writing is basically private writing. No one's going to grade it. No one's going to look at it. It's probably ghastly. Right, technically, it's probably ghastly writing. It doesn't matter. So some examples of this are, and this I used a lot in the elementary years, from the classical homeschooling idea of using narrative. It's also a Charlotte Mason term, where you just write down a summary of what you read in a history reading or a science reading or a literature reading. I didn't do it in literature, but you could. But when you're studying something, writing down in your own words is a fantastic way of memorizing, or not memorizing, but learning stuff. And, you know, when you take notes, I mean, I realized that when I was in college, I used to always take my notes. And then at the end of the term, I'd go back and I'd look at my notes and I'd try to rewrite them a little. It would have saved me a lot of time and effort if I'd actually summarized the lecture or whatever, the reading, immediately afterwards. I would have learned a lot more easily, I think. And I found that incredibly effective. For my own children, they'll watch a lecture and then they'll take notes and then they'll write a paragraph summary of what was said. And it's that act of writing it down puts it into your head in a way that simply taking notes or simply watching a lecture or reading a book won't put it in your mind in the same way. So that's one aspect of service writing. Another aspect of service writing might be just free writing. I'm sort of interested in this topic. What do I know about it? What do I think? What are some possibilities for writing about it? But all of it, the presentation doesn't matter. The structure doesn't matter. It's using words to think. And you're going to grow your understanding by exploring it in writing. And that's a huge contrast to the way writing was taught in the old days under the classical education model, where teachers were interested in your product. They weren't interested in your process of how you got there and how you wrote. And student writing was supposed to be showing that moment, you know, getting to that spark notes moment of, I thought the symbolism of X was Y and talking about it. Whereas in service writing, you're sitting there, it's almost like having a private conversation with yourself in your writing. Well, maybe it's like this, or maybe it's like this, and this made me feel like that. And it's not formal. You wouldn't hand it in for a paper grade, but it's just getting you there, getting you thinking, getting you exploring in your writing. So with my children, I've used service writing right the way through. When they were very small, I used to read it, but once they were in sort of fourth grade, I just kind of looked over to see if there was actually writing on the page. It could have been something completely different. I wouldn't have known. And now in high school, I just kind of flip through the notebooks once in a while and say, have you been doing this? But it's really beneficial for learning and for starting off on a more complex piece of writing. The other kind of writing I think about is draft and a half writing. And this is what we as adults use all the time. Whether you're writing a letter or an article or a blog, you just write something quickly and then have a quick read over it. Is it look okay? Is it all right? Yeah, make some corrections, maybe rearrange a few paragraphs and hit update. You know, you're not putting a lot of work into it, but you're polishing it up. It's not really a multi-draft piece of work. I think a lot of times in schools, they'll be trying to teach the process of writing, but what they're really teaching is this draft and a half, where you just clean it up a little bit. You don't really revise it in any significant way. And I think about the revision process as what I call invested writing, which is something that it's a topic or a paper that's really important to a student, and that student's spending a lot of time over it, writing it, rewriting it. A lot of times students will want to write a paper about a subject. I can't think of one off the top of my head, but one of my daughters would write about dogs. She loves dogs. So she's stopped doing this a little bit now, but she might write about that in different ways, fiction, nonfiction, dog training, dog breeds, how many dogs Sweden and Victoria had. You're coming at it over and over again from a different angle, and that's fine. Students who write about the same topic in different ways are getting a lot out of it. You don't have to say to yourself, I mean, maybe once in a while you could suggest a new topic, but in general, it's okay to revisit those old favorites. But the invested writing is, students can do that at any age. I'm much more inclined to push for it in middle school and high school, where they work on a topic over weeks, maybe leaving it aside for a while and then going back. I ask them to really think about the quality of writing and does the structure get across their ideas as well as it could. And so these are the kinds of papers that they might really spend a long time on, and the end product might look completely different from the beginning. I don't think it's necessary. Some writing programs teach that kind of deep investment in every piece of writing, and I don't think that's necessary. I think having some skill in going fast and doing the draft and the half writing is very valuable too. They all kind of feed into each other.
Well, you said, if I remember correctly from your book, that with the, I believe it was the invested writing, you mentioned that roughly for whatever grade they are is how many papers they would do in that given year. Is that correct? So if they're a third grader, then there should be about 3 pieces of invested writing that they would have done during the course of the year?
Yeah, I mean, I just sort of thought about it, and that seemed to line up pretty well. It's not rigid in any way. You know, some students, like I said, might just keep going back and back again to the same paper. And if there's actual real work being done there, there's nothing wrong with that. So the third grader just spent all year working on and off on one piece, that would be fine too. But the one invested piece per grade level is kind of it's a loose rule of thumb. If you have a student who always wants to start stuff up and not go back and not rewrite anything, then that could be used to kind of push that student to do a little bit more depth in a couple of pieces. And if you had a student who really didn't want to do anything, then you could say, well, okay, you've got to do three. So it's more of a, I want it to be a help, that idea, not dogma.
Right. Not write any dogma. Right. Yeah. Right. Okay, fabulous. There's a section in your book, well, there's several sections in your book that I have highlighted, but one in particular that I wanted a chance to speak with you about, because for me anyway, quite frankly, you say something completely different than the majority of the information that is out there in the homeschooling community. And I'm fascinated by this, and so I wanted to give opportunity to have you expand on this. There's a passage in your book under the subtopic of making schoolwork relevant, where you have said that so much of the modern curricular planning is about making school relevant, but you don't think we need to do that for our children. In fact, you say, forget about making it relevant for your children and let the connections come in non-school time. Knowledge makes things interesting. And to me, that's just almost the antithesis of what we hear so much, you know, for those of us who, which I think the majority of homeschooling parents are, you know, we're constantly on the prowl for what would work, what would entice our children, what excites them, how do we help them find their passion to pursue their purpose, and, you know, all these wonderful ideas. I'm not poo-pooing the ideas, but you're the first person that I, anyway, now maybe to the classical homeschooling community, they're thinking, well, of course. but being an eclectic homeschooler, this is the first time I've really seen someone say, forget about making it relevant for your children. That's something that comes in their non-school time. It's the knowledge that makes things interesting. So I'm a little wow by this statement, and I was wondering if you could maybe just expand a little bit more on that. And in keeping with that same vein then, so how do you motivate your students, your children, when it's a subject that they have absolutely no interest in, but you've deemed it relevant or worthwhile?
So for me, a lot of it is making sure that they still have enough time to get that unschooling aspect of life in and get the play in and get time outside. You know, one of the things I didn't like about classical homeschooling is it seems to take all day. And in elementary school, sometimes this didn't happen, but I wanted them out of the door by, you know, lunch at 12, out at 1, and don't come back till it gets dark. So I think that by one of my objections to, you know, doing lots of project-based learning, I think some of it's great. And if I were a different person, I would probably have a lot more time for it. It's not something that suits me, so I'm sort of too bad for my kids. But I mean that kind of in a sarcastic way, because they do all those projects. But they do it on their own, and they don't necessarily involve me, apart from saying, could you clean that up? But I think that I want school to be, it's a really important part of our lives as a family, but I don't want it to consume everything. And when I tend to get cross about school, it's because it's taking too long. And my daughter yesterday was like, why are you so irritated? I said, because you haven't gone outside. You stop working. Go away. Go outside. And that may seem odd by coming from someone who's so academic and I got to do really well in school. I do want them to have other things going on in their lives. So with regard to the making school relevant, the reason I'm not worried about that is I probably divide the school day more into subjects than a lot of homeschooling families. And so it's a bit school at home in that way. And part of it is I'm kind of just checking things off in my mind. I'm not even doing it on paper. But when they were little, if we walked around and we spent the afternoon looking at ants, I sort of ticked off my mind, okay, we've done some science. I don't need to worry about science. We looked at ants all afternoon, right? And then maybe we go back and Google ants and find out a little bit more about them. And that was unschooling, but I was kind of consciously ticking off in my mind that we'd done that part. And we do a little bit of, when they were learning to read, we do our 15, 20 minutes of explicit phonics. I did try to market that to them. But I didn't really care whether it was a way that interested them. Part of it was I didn't have access to a lot of choice. We were geographically isolated. I had to buy all my resources once a year, and I was stuck with whatever I had. So there was an element to that. If I had had Amazon, you know, and the internet, and I might have been a very different kind of teacher. But when they were reading, I tried to market it to them that we're just going to do this. Get through it. 20 minutes a day, you'll know how to read, and then I'll leave you alone. So we worked at that very thoroughly, and I was really consistent about, let's just do this every day. I found that when we took weekends off, Mondays, Tuesdays, we did nothing because we were sort of getting back into the groove of school. So I probably was more school at home than a lot of people in that regard. But I think in terms of spending a lot of time as a homeschooling teacher, for me, finding those projects, developing projects, isn't where I wanted to spend my time. I wanted to just say, okay, we'll read these history stories. Now, there were books that were absolute failures, and a lot of them I hung on too long. You know, I should have just said, this is pretty boring. We should move on. So in that sense, I tried to be responsive to what my kids needed and didn't like. But I felt that if I could keep school as condensed as possible, that they would have enough time to do their own projects.
Fabulous. So I'm going to tap on this subject with the hammer just a little bit more. So then in not being as concerned about the subject matter is relevant for your children or they're necessarily passionate or excited about it, how do you motivate a child either in a subject or a topic that you've deemed important for them to cover but they have no interest in? Or how do you just motivate your children? Some of us have children who seem to be motivated by nothing. My daughter, for example, she finds little things here and there. We've been homeschooling now since she's a freshman, and we've been homeschooling since the start of second grade. And there have been moments throughout the years, of course, where she's latched onto something. She spent an inordinate amount of time just absolutely consumed with the Titanic disaster. And we would follow rabbit holes based off of that. And my daughter's a theater kid. She loves all things movies and Broadway and musicals and that sort of thing. And I'm lucky she loves Shakespeare and that sort of thing. But she has had very few interests that really spark her. And I struggled. I tried to make things relevant for her. She's a very intrapersonal connection person, you know, what's the meaning of this towards me or to the world today and that sort of thing. But how do you help that child or do you bother? Or do you just say, as part of the structure of your school, well, this is what you're going to learn about the Industrial Revolution, whether it's interesting to you or not. And you don't worry so much about, quote unquote, motivating them. What is your perspective on that? You know, motivating the reluctant learner, not just the reluctant reader, but the reluctant learner.
Part of it, I think, I try to market it by being enthusiastic about it myself. There are probably things that I haven't covered because, frankly, I'm not very enthusiastic about them. So I'm feeling a lot of guilt that they haven't done as much computer programming as perhaps they should have, because I'm not very good at it. But I think that in terms of, say, with my kids, I say, yeah, we are going to study the Industrial Revolution, whether you want to or not. It doesn't really come up. I mean, I don't have to put it in those words. I think because I have had a fair amount of structure through the years, we study the next thing in history, and they know that something is going to come along that they're maybe not as interested in. But I do try to find a way in that they will be interested about it. And one of the things that actually comes back a little bit to reading stamina is that if you read history textbooks, they're really, really boring. They almost have to be. I mean, they're trying to achieve so much in so little space. I can't read the history textbook. I mean, I can't face it. I love history. But reading 10 pages in a textbook, if you read about that same story, in that same time period, in 200-300-page books, it's easier. It's easier to read 600 pages than it is to read 10. So I tried, as soon as I could possibly get away with it, I really pushed them on this. I moved from reading history books, textbooks, into reading popular adult, their nonfiction historical things, most of them written by journalists. And they always have much more room for the story side of it. They have more room for the little details, the number of dogs who were there. So, you know, when we're doing American history, instead of reading an American history textbook in middle school, they read 1776, they read Mayflower, they read The Secrets of Mary Bowser, they read The Red Badge of Courage. And they can't tell you the acts names, they can't tell you the exact dates that things happen, but they have a very good sense of what it was like for people in that time period and what they were worried about and what they took for granted. So, okay, in that sense, I'm making them things relevant for them by the mode that I'm teaching, but I'm not making it relevant by saying, oh, you don't think American history is interesting? Well, you don't have to study it. I'm fairly dogmatic about, okay, we're going to go through this cycle in history. We're going to study these topics now in high school. We're going to study these topics in science. We're going to do math every day. And that was probably the biggest struggle, the biggest motivational struggle. And so on. So I think I do have a lot of structure in the things that I'm teaching in school. And the things that I'm teaching in school are by definition the things that they wouldn't do on their own. So that structure, I think, is how I fake the motivation.
So this is all just so fascinating to me. So for that unschooling-ish side of your homeschooling methodology, do you ever, or maybe you haven't, but would you have any advice for someone if there was nothing that your child actually showed an interest in? I mean, do you try at all to make sure that what they're doing in that free unschooling time that they have, or do you, if what they wanted to do had no real academic relevance, you would be fine with that? And if you were involved in a situation, I know you're with the, I am, let me just start all over again. That was just a flipping mess. You have a very interesting situation, fascinating, that you spend a great deal of time traveling with your chartering service that you provide, and you're on a boat and in foreign countries and stuff, and you've said that, you know, you don't have the access that a lot of homeschoolers do to electronics and so on and so forth. If you had a different personal experience, would you limit the amount of electronics or television or those sort of things that your girls were allowed to participate in order to keep that unschooling, you know, be driven by your interests sort of aspect of it going? Or how do you think you would do that?
I probably would set limits. I mean, I think I'm pretty proactive in, especially when they were younger, saying, you will do this and you won't do that. So I was probably more dogmatic about that. It wasn't an issue for us, so I didn't have to worry about it because we didn't have the internet. But I didn't have them, you know, it's funny, actually, when we first set off on the boat, they were very, very young. We had a friend sailing with us, and they had a leap pad, you know, one of those little things, and it sings songs and stuff. And he said he didn't have kids at the time, and he said to me after the kids had been playing with it, do you know your children are different after they've been playing that? And I said, no, and I thought it was great. They were learning the alphabet and the days of the week and all this sort of thing. And he said, they expect you to react immediately to them after they've been doing it. It's like they're pushing your button and they expect to have an answer from you, and they're not as patient as they are normally. And I really took that to heart, and I started watching them and noticed that, yeah, he was right. They were expecting much more instant gratification after a session on the leap pad. So I just sort of got rid of that and sort of let them know that they had to be part of the family. So I probably would have restricted it if they were, you know, that had been a possibility for us. My husband and I don't play video games. We do watch a lot of movies. We love surfing the internet. My kids don't like doing Facebook because they say that's what our mother does. So I obviously do that too much. So I think that I would have been. But now when they're in high school, I don't really restrict their time on the internet. They tend to use most of it for finding stuff out and, you know, learning things. I might be more cautious if they were doing a lot of, you know, games and I don't think that those things are bad at all. I just wouldn't want them to do that to the exclusion of everything else, and especially the exclusion of going outside and climbing mountains and being out in the wild, which is obviously we have a huge advantage with that because we are in the wild. And a lot of people, if you're in a city, you don't have those options. But I think it's probably a parent's job to say, yeah, you're doing that too much. We need to cut back a little bit. And I wouldn't have a problem with, you know, shutting down the Wi-Fi during dinner and during the evening or something like that if that was a problem for us. You know, I've been at dinner parties where all the teenagers are on their phones texting under the table, and they think everyone doesn't know. And I just find that, it's good to know how to turn it off.
Well, let's talk a little bit about something that not a lot of leaders in the homeschooling community actually address. And I think it's great that you talk about this. You talk about homeschoolers who are homeschooling because they need to. There's some sort of circumstance that driven them to choose homeschooling. And then there is those who do it because they want to, for more than likely, you know, philosophical or educational reasons. And you talk about that there's a little bit of a difference there. So shall we chat about that for a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, I think and many people who start off because they have to end up saying, probably like I'm probably in that category, now I can't imagine putting my kids into school. So I've become a philosophical homeschooler, but I wasn't. And actually, I'm not. I think that public school can be a fantastic option for people, and so I have a lot of interest in people who are just going to homeschool for a year or for a semester, whether they're traveling or the child's sick or the child's bullied or whatever reason. And I think it can be quite hard to find a place in the homeschooling community if you're just coming for a year. You know, you're not really in it for philosophical reasons. I've read people saying, you know, this is the hardest thing because we don't have any support. We're I just want a curriculum. I just want to do, someone described it as doing one and done. You know, they just wanted to experiment with it, but not stick with it. And it's a quite a different problem, as it were, if you're trying to prepare your students to go back into a public school or a private school, because the whole idea of keeping on grade level becomes much more important. If you're looking at 12 years of homeschooling, it really doesn't matter if your students are on grade level, because you've got time, you've 12 years to catch up. Or you know what, you could take 13 or 14 years over and it doesn't matter. Or they could go to college at 15. There's all these different options if you're in it for the long term. If you're in it for the short term, you really have to keep up in some ways. In some ways, I think you don't. But what I tend to advise to people is, okay, let's see if you can keep up in math. Because math in the U.S. is a subject that tends to be taught very strictly by grade level, particularly in elementary and middle school. And if you miss third grade math, you can't just slot into fourth grade math. It's really, really tough. So for those homeschoolers, I say, well, get a curriculum, follow it through, go back if you have to. A lot of times students can really benefit from going back because they may not have understood some of the year before or 2 years before. But to me, that's the one thing that makes slotting back into public school really difficult. Would be to not do math. So that seems to me the most important thing. And from there, I mean, for people who are traveling or the child's sick, or they'll probably be just fine if they read and write and do math. I think history and science and foreign language are so important to, you know, creating a well-educated person. But if you're only going to be teaching them for a year, those things become much less important because they can be caught up. You can catch up when they get back to school. So I think people, I always feel like I don't really think I should be giving permission, but I feel like when I'm talking to people online or whatever, I'm giving permission to say, don't worry about it. It's fine. They'll be fine. You know, you can skip third grade and go right back into fourth, as long as you've been keeping up with the math. And then I always want to say, well, and lots of free reading, and maybe they could keep a journal too. And then I keep going, and then I start ending up getting to a full curriculum. But that's not what I want to do. Because I think you need to, if the parents are going to be taking responsibility for it, they need reassurance that you know, it will be fine and they can go back in. I haven't had this experience because my kids have been at home all the time, but I can imagine, and I've had friends in this situation, that it's particularly hard when you're pulling a child for bullying. Because by pulling the child, you're kind of creating another thing perhaps that they could be bullied about, but you've got to do what's right for your child. And if the child's in a terrible situation in school, you've just got to do it. And so one of the things I'm interested in looking at is how you can take care of a child. And a lot of people recommend de-schooling when you start homeschooling for the first time. I mean, some people take it to the extreme of saying you should do a month for every year the child's been in school. But I think that only really applies if you're going to homeschool the rest of the way through. If you're going to try to slot right back into public school the next year, you probably don't have time for that. You do have 3 months in the summer where you can catch up a little bit, but I think parents need to kind of have the confidence that, or should be encouraged to have the confidence that if the child's in a terrible situation, even if you don't teach them very much, they're probably going to have a better year. And be emotionally and better off for it, which will make them academically better off for it. You can't learn when you're terrified, and you can't learn when you're miserable. So there's really no point in trying. So I think you know, parents can have the confidence that if they keep up with math, that they should be able to keep the child back into school. And if they don't have confidence in that, or they really want to, then there's a lot of fantastic whole box curriculums which have every subject in there. And that's not the right route for me, but I think it can be a fantastic route for parents who don't want to go to the sort of stress level and the trouble of developing their own curriculum. You know, something like Oak Meadow, Calvert's a bit more, a little bit more classical style, less about the student. Oak Meadow's more focused on the student. One of those programs, I don't like them for long-term homeschoolers because I think most students are a little ahead or a little behind, and it's easier to mix and match. But, you know, if you're only doing it for 1 year, something like that can be a fantastic option, and it can give you the courage to do it and confidence you need. So not everybody has to do it the way I do it.
Right. Well, and oftentimes, too, now, when people ask me what I would recommend, you know, they just want to pull their child out for, you know, the year or so, there's so many of the states now here in the United States, you know, offer the free online public school that you can be at home, and then that way you're out of the whatever the environment is that's troubling at the brick and mortar school, and still be exactly right on track with what the public schools for that state offer. So oftentimes I tell folks that they might be interested in looking into that if they're just looking for that 1 year break for whatever, whether, you know, there's been people send me messages, you know, that there's an illness in the family or that they had death or, you know, they've changed circumstances in some way or another. And so do you concur that online schooling through the public school system is also another option for those who are seeking a short-term homeschool solution?
Definitely. I mean, it's really, and it may be something that they could start off with and then go some other way. One thing that's important for high school students, or can be important, is that their transcript is accredited. If you're homeschooling right the way through, it's not important. Colleges, and all the ones I've looked at, don't care whether your high school is accredited or not. But if you're going back into a high school, they may care very much that the transcript is official. And so something like the online program or buying teacher support can be very helpful in getting the work counted as part of the high school transcript. Usually what a high school will do is if you come from another high school or you come from an accredited homeschooling program, either online or something like Oak Meadow or Calvert's all online now for high school. But they will actually list those courses on their transcript. So when you apply to college, you have a transcript with the names of every course listed. So if you've just taught at home without that outside teacher support or without the online program, they often, not every school district, but they will give you trouble about that. And they may say, well, you haven't taken English 1, so we won't put it on your transcript. And that can be a problem for competing in college athletics. It can be a problem just for getting into college. So those online things are probably most useful for a high school student or a late middle school student.
Right.
For elementary school, personally, I find paper coursework probably better. That's kind of a philosophical thing. But for elementary school students, I wanted my kids to be working from books. And of course, I include a Kindle in that, so I'm not all paper. It has to be paper. But what I don't like about online programs for elementary school students, and obviously as one component of it, it can be great, but for online work, they really have to ask you multiple choice questions. There isn't a lot of way to get around that. And now, I haven't looked at every program. There may be some programs that can do that. But without a teacher evaluating it, multiple choice is the easiest way to do it. And I don't think that multiple choice is the best way to test students' knowledge. They don't think about things. If they just have to pick the right answer, or they can guess. That's why I'm not really in favor for online education for elementary school students. And probably actually not for a middle school or high school, but I recognize that, especially with the accreditation issue, it can be really important.
Right, right. And not that it matters, but I completely agree with you about the for the short-term homeschooling. If you keep up with the math, I think that's probably the most. Obviously, reading is important. Reading is everything, but if you keep up with the math, because even though we are now entering high school, and my daughter is planning on doing all of high school as a homeschooler. Every now and then through the years of homeschooling, she's considered going back to public school for one reason or another, and I can't discount that she might not consider it again. And that's the one area that we've always said, well, because math is her most challenging subject, so I've always said, well, if you want to go back to school next year, we've really got to focus on your math. And so for a short-term homeschooler, I would completely concur that if you keep up with their math, the rest of it is totally workable. But you can't skip third grade or fourth grade or fifth grade math and then think that it's okay to hop into the next grade level, for sure. So that's fabulous, yeah. So one of the things that I've been asking all the interviewees, is the ever-present question that I think can help a lot of, especially new homeschoolers, for those of us who've been doing it for a while, which is, if there were one thing you could go back and start all over again, and there were one thing that you could do differently from what you know today, what would that one thing be that you did differently, that one piece of advice that you have for those starting out on this journey, that one thing you wish you knew then or wish you'd done then?
Well, I've thought this often. It's sort of particular to our situation, but we were spending a lot of time in South America at that time, and I didn't put the kids into school, and so this is kind of an odd thing coming from a homeschooling perspective. I'm really sorry I didn't put the kids into school. They're kind of learning Spanish as high schoolers now, and I just banged my head against the wall because they could have just gone in and taken it all in and learned it without any effort. At the time, there were various reasons we didn't do it, and it would have been quite difficult to do. And I thought at the time, well, they'll pick it up anyway. They didn't. And partially, they're so close in age that they played together and they didn't. If they'd been only children, they might have worked harder at trying to learn the language. But learning languages at a young age is so easy if you can put them in a real immersion situation. If you can't, just doing Muzzy or something, we did all that. It didn't really help. Rosetta Stone, it didn't help. But if they could have actually gone to school, I think they would. That would have been a great thing.
Oh, okay. So I guess the lesson that can be extrapolated from that is whenever you come upon an opportunity, seize it, because you don't know that opportunity is necessarily going to present itself again.
Yes, especially with languages, because it is a lot easier for a young person to learn a language. And at the time, I thought that their math and their English and so on were so important. You said earlier I was academic, and I think that is a time when they were 6 and 7 years old that it really didn't matter. And I could have slacked off a little and said it doesn't matter that they're not studying history this year. They're learning Spanish, and I should have done that. That's probably the one thing that I really wish I'd done differently.
And did you come to homeschooling your children? Did you always know you were going to homeschool your children from the time they were born or the time they were little, or did you come to homeschooling as a result of the lifestyle that you and your husband have with the travel and the boating, or how did you come to homeschooling?
Well, we were actually in the process. We'd worked on a boat for somebody else before, and while they were born, we were actually building the boat. And so during their, you know, so right from the beginning of their childhoods, we had this plan of doing the charter work. It was very similar to the work we've been doing before. So in that sense, I did know that we were going to be homeschooling right from the beginning. If we had been doing a different kind of job, I don't think I necessarily would have been homeschooling. So it was a geographic decision that we weren't going to be in one place and we weren't going to be in town for schools. But it was something I did know right from the beginning that we were very likely to be homeschooling.
And so having been homeschooling all these years, you said that if you hadn't maybe had this lifestyle, they would have been in regular school. Are you glad then? Are you thankful that homeschooling is what worked out for you all? Or do you think that they would have been as equally benefited by if they had attended regular school?
I'm incredibly grateful that we did it. It's been an amazing experience, not one that I really would have sought out if we hadn't needed to do it. But our family, we know each other really, really well because of the homeschooling, because we're always near each other. And part of that, too, is because my husband and I both, our work is at home as well on the boat. And the kids now, I mean, they're a huge help. They weren't always such a help with the charter work, but they now are a fantastic crew. So it's been such a great thing for us to have them at home. When I say if I'd been doing some other kind of job, they probably would have gone to school. I say that they would have been in school, but actually, I think I would have been still doing a great deal of homeschooling. And I look at my friends with kids in school, and they're all homeschool teachers, really. I mean, they all my friends who are interested in their children's academics, they're all involved. They're very involved. Some of them are doing a lot more than I am in terms of, you know, drilling times tables. I mean, I was terrible at that. I should have been better. But, you know, they're all involved in projects. They're all involved in knowing what's going on in school. So I'm pretty sure that I would have been homeschooling in that sense, even if they had gone to school and staying very involved with it. I don't think
right.
I wouldn't have been completely hands-off.
No, right, no. I know I wasn't, even though she was just for her, you know, her very early elementary, my daughter was in school. I was very involved parent, too, to the point that once the struggles became apparent and I had a teacher conference and I asked the teacher for more detail about what they could do to help my daughter, and when she said to me, well, perhaps if you would work with her at home. And I thought, I have been working with her at home. And then I thought, well, you know what? Why don't I just be the one that works with her at home? And that's how we became homeschoolers. So I completely understand and relate to what you're saying. So, well, Kate, this has been fabulous. If you have something else you'd like to add to the conversation, I'm all ears. But I recommend your book. Again, it's Homeschool Teacher, A Practical Guide to Inspiring Academic Excellence by Kate Laird. And I don't often recommend how-to homeschool books, but yours was very eye-opening to me and came at a good time as I'm trying to navigate these high school waters that we now find ourselves in with a daughter who is sure that she wants to not only attend college, but participate in our Move On When Ready program where she can start taking community college classes next year. I think this has been fabulous. You are a treasure trove of very helpful information, and I thank you so much for spending this time with us today for School Choice Week.
Oh, thank you very much, Mary. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
All right. Well, I hope that one of these days we get to meet face to face at some homeschooling conference or something somewhere. It would be wonderful to meet you in person.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and safe travels on the rest of your excursions for the year.
Thank you.
All right, well, thank you so much for joining us with SEED Homeschoolers for School Choice Week. And remember to be on the lookout for SEED Homeschoolers' new podcast programming that will start on March 1st with your host, Blair Lee, and myself, Mary B., where we will be talking all things secular, all things eclectic and academic. And have a great rest of the week.